Evening Under Lamplight on Cambridge 105 Radio.
Here is a special announcement. Today is Tuesday, and not, as is announced in today's Sunday Telegraph, Friday. And now, a repeat of last Thursday's performance of Monday Night is Music Night.
Here's me, Robert Louis Abrahamson, behind the mic, and there's you in front of some sort of speaker, or maybe with speakers attached to your head in one way or another. And that means it's time for us to share this evening's Evening Under Lamplight on Cambridge 105 Radio. As I mentioned at the end of the show last time, the theme this evening is games. We'll play around with this concept, this activity, and see what might be opened up to us. And as we do this, you, of course, are invited to attend. I suppose we have, first of all, to define what we mean by a game. How's this for what is called a formal definition? A game is an activity in which the player submits to certain rules of procedure and competes either against others or against some standard of attainment, not for any practical gain, but for the sheer pleasure of playing. I'll do that again. A game is an activity in which the player submits to certain rules of procedure and competes either against others or against some standard of attainment, not for any practical gain, but for the sheer pleasure of playing. Is that a useful definition? I think it brings in what to me are the essential two points. Games have rules that we agree to abide by, and we play a game for its own sake, not for any gain. People who break the rules in a game have committed a foul, and the game stops to readjust itself. Too many fouls, and you are excluded from the game. And people who play only to win are called, or used to be called, unsportsmanlike. They have misunderstood the purpose of the activity. To be sure, we want to win, and we do all we can within the bounds of the rules to make sure we win. But the desire to win is just part of the game. Once the game is over, we shake hands with our opponent and forget who won or who lost. It's competition, but a friendly competition. Too much aggressiveness is unsportsmanlike. Of course, I'm speaking in the ideal. And it seldom works out like that, given our human failings. But this is, I think, the way we feel a game is supposed to be played. And this is why many people get so upset when professional players get paid so much money. The game then loses its spirit and is about money, not just for the players, but for the owners and all the other hangers-on. It's about money, not about the sport itself. In fact, you know all about that controversy about professional athletes versus amateur athletes. Amateurs, as the word implies, it means lovers, are playing for the love of the game, not for their own or anyone else's gain. And they retain the true spirit of the game. And this takes us to another point. Because we're not out for prestige, power, or money, as is usually the case in the ordinary world, we can see that games set up an alternative reality for the time being, a world with its own rules, its own scorecard. And when we step out of that world back to the real world again, we don't bring that scorecard with us. Oh yes, big end-of-the-season games are usually extended into huge parades for the winners, But these celebrations are expressions of the emotional high generated by the game itself. And at their best, they are occasions of good cheer, good fellowship, and not occasions for chauvinistic boasting or partisanship. And here, to give us a little break, is a little scherzo by Beethoven from Sonata No. 5 in F major for violin and piano. A scherzo is a playful piece of music whose primary aim, I suppose, is just to have fun in the performance. It comes from the Italian word for a joke or for playing around. So, we play games in order to play games, not even in order to prove ourselves or even just to improve ourselves. Those things are not bad things to do, but they're not the essence of games or sport. In fact, the word sport is a shortening of the older word dissport, which means a diversion from serious duties. A relaxation, recreation, entertainment, amusement, all of these being things we do for their own sake. Yeah, lots of health advisors these days keep telling us that it's good for us to relax and have fun. It lowers the blood pressure, for instance. That may be true, but then it's no longer a diversion or even entertainment. It's just a kind of drug to improve the body. Good in its own way, but not the spirit of sport, which challenges us to be in the moment and do something simply for its own sake. Games demonstrate that the ends do not justify the means. That is, it's not a question of winning or losing, but of how you play the game. Again, that's the ideal, that's the spirit of sport, though our modern cynical world likes to defy this. Good guys come last, we're told, and the worst thing that could happen to us, endorsed by every word and action of the man sitting in the White House, the worst thing that could happen is to come in last. We must win by whatever means we can. Yes, that seems an understandingly human attitude, but let's take a minute to consider what this attitude does to us. We certainly have a few minutes of ego pleasure at winning, moments of triumph, but we have also set ourselves up to be cut off from others. They're losers, worse than I am. I'm better than they are, different from them by being better. I no longer, then, have to care about them, the suckers. So now my ego is inflated, but my world is smaller, and this cannot satisfy for long. A short while later, and we need another triumph, another fix to inflate our ego. And this means using any means we can find to put down or oppress everyone else. It's not a pretty life, even if we're showered with power, prestige, and possessions. It produces a loneliness that makes us want to die if we aren't dead already.
Two, three. Yes, I'm lonely. girl, you know the reason why. You know the reason why.
Poor John Lennon, caught up in that world of prestige and possession, if not also power, though his power comes through the heavy rocking in songs like this. The opening minute of Your Blues from the Beatles' White Album. I said before that one of the chief characteristics of games is that their alternative reality is defined by rules, the rules of the game. The players in the game do not just passively obey the rules like good, honest citizens. The real fun comes from stretching the rules, stretching them as far as we can without breaking them. Do you see that distinction? In tennis, for instance, you're breaking the rules if you hit the ball beyond the boundary, out of bounds. You break the rules and the game stops for a moment to readjust itself. But what you want to do is hit the ball as close as you can to the boundary line, just barely keeping within bounds, thus perhaps fooling your opponent and winning you the point. That's a kind of deceit, of course. But a deceit that both parties agree to, as long as the deceit takes place within the rules. Maybe instead of deceit, we would call it a bluff. Games are all about bluffing, which is another form of pretending. And games, like all play, are about pretending. And in connection with this, here's a poem by Robert Francis, a poet who spent most of his life in Amherst, following on from the two other Amherst poets, Emily Dickinson and Robert Frost. This poem is called simply Pitcher. It's one of Francis's baseball poems. In baseball, the pitcher throws the ball to the batter, who tries to hit the ball. The pitcher is constantly deceiving the batter by appearing to throw the ball one way at one speed, but veering from that apparent intent. A game of bluff, you see. Well, here's the poem. His art is eccentricity. His aim, how not to hit the mark he seems to aim at. His passion, how to avoid the obvious. His technique, how to vary the avoidance. The others throw to be comprehended. He throws to be a moment misunderstood. Yet not too much. Not errant, arrant, wild, but every seeming aberration willed. Not to, yet still to communicate, making the batter understand too late.
Oh, I gotcha! Uh-huh! You thought you got away from me, didn't you? You thought I didn't see you now, didn't you? You tried to sneak by me now, didn't you? You thought you'd been slick now, didn't you? Now give me what you promised me. Give it to you! Ow!
That little intrusion was from Joe Tex, the opening of the song I Gotcha. It's an exciting opening, the kind of thing a pitcher might say when he successfully bluffs the batter, or conversely, the batter might say when he successfully sees through his opponent's bluff. But I cut off the song there. It just descends into awful nastiness. You promised me the day that you quit your boyfriend that I'd be the next one to ease on in. You saw me and ran in another direction. I'll teach you to play with my affection. Now give it here. Don't say nothing, just give it here. You see, this isn't a game anymore, but some kind of marketplace where you make deals and you move around the displays to grab whatever pleases you, and if you can't get it, you turn aggressive. This is an example of a game gone wrong, transforming into a power play. It could have been so delightful and elegant if his pride hadn't sprung up and if he hadn't been so insistent on getting what he thought he deserved. Games don't flourish in that spirit. But back for a minute to higher things, to Robert Francis's poem. You want to come close to breaking the rules and seem to be throwing the pitch outside of the strike zone, but not quite outside. Not errant, arrant, wild, but every seeming aberration willed. And so it is with that other kind of game, poetry. Notice the apparent repetition of the same word, errant, errant, and arrant, arrant. It's not quite the same word, but they sound very close. And the seeming aberration of wild and its near rhyme willed. Not errant, arrant, wild, but every seeming aberration willed. He's playing with the sounds of the poem as a good poet should, and inviting us to play with him as he teases us or bluffs us with the interplay between sounds and meanings. In fact, all art is a game, both between the painter or sculptor or musician or writer or whatever, between the artist and the material the artist is working with, paint, marble, sounds, words, and also a game between the artist and the viewer or listener or reader or whatever. Robert Frost said that all poetry is dramatic poetry because there's a drama between the poet and the reader. All art is, in this sense, drama too. And, of course, another word for a piece of drama is a play. It's all a game, and stage drama is just another form of bluff. The actors and stagehands bluffing that this is some sort of reality being represented here, requiring from us what the poet Coleridge called a willing suspension of disbelief, the same as the disbelief we bring to any kind of game, such as when we pretend a football player cannot touch the ball with his hands, even though we know that if this was real life, he perfectly well could. Now, if a player accidentally breaks the rules, if, to take our example, a football player inadvertently touches the ball with his hand, then there's nothing more to be done except restart the play. But if the player is seen to be deliberately breaking the rules, well, that's called cheating, isn't it? And this is a relatively serious problem. The game is not just halted and restarted, the cheater is actually expelled from the game. Back to the loneliness of the sidelines, not allowed to engage in playing because the cheater isn't really interested in playing, only in winning, and that's not sporting. Hey, did you flinch when I just said it's not sporting? Do we ever use that word, sporting, seriously anymore? If we don't, it's a sign of how far our cynical culture has come from the idea of playing a game for its own sake, not in order to win. That kind of idealism feels very old-fashioned, doesn't it? And not only old-fashioned, but in disrepute. That great British ideal of being a good sport, old chap, was abused and became hypocritical over the years, often just being applied to public school games and used to put down everyone else. It passed away with the British Empire, didn't it? Didn't it? Ray Davies felt this back in 1973 when he gave us the song Cricket on the Kinks' Preservation Part 1 album. I'll just play the song. It's self-explanatory. Even the technical cricket terms are, in the context of the song, self-explanatory. Anything more I could say about it would detract from its effect.
Some people say that life's a game. Well, if this is so, I'd like to know the rules on which the game of life is based. I know of no game more fitting than the age-old game of cricket. It has honour, it has character, and is British. Now God laid down the rules of life when he wrote those Ten Commandments, and to cricket those ten same rules shall apply. So show compassion and self-righteousness, and be honest above all, and come to God's call with bat and ball. Sinful Satan, and he's out to take your wicket, and you know that that's not cricket.
He'll baffle you with googlies, with leg breaks and off spin, but keep a level head and don't let that demon in. So keep a straight bat at all times, let the Bible be your guide. Get by.
All through your life, he'll try to bowl you out. Beware the demon bowler. He's crafty and deceitful, and he'll try to LBW and bowl.
Devil takes the weak in spirit, so we must always be courageous and remember that God is on your side. Oh, Satan in your sights, play the straight and narrow line.
Who else could do that but Ray Davies? All right, that's cricket, giving us the rules of the game of life. It's all a game. And yes, if we can move beyond our cynicism, life is a game. And our task, we who are living our lives right now, our task is both to play the game and be a spectator of the game, the delight of playing and the delight of watching how it's going, both in and out of the game, as Walt Whitman put it, both in and out of the game and watching and wondering at it. So keep a straight bat at all times, the song tells us, and let the Bible be your guide and you'll get by. And maybe that's the problem here. Religion is just another game for this self-righteous speaker, something apart from real life. Well, that's true, of course. All religions just provide us maps of reality. But if it's done in the spirit of just getting by, that is, not losing in life, then, well, it's not sporting after all, and it's a bad map. But we here at Evening Under Lamplight are always trying to provide you with the very best in maps for your journey. And I hope you find our maps handy, even when they are just bluffs. For we are also playing a game, as you know, and one of the rules of this radio game is to identify ourselves. So here goes.
Evening Under Lamplight on Cambridge 105 Radio.
And I'm your host, Robert Louis Abrahamson, and we're talking this evening under lamplight about different aspects of games. I suspect we may be talking about games in ways you've never considered before. That's the kind of maps we offer here.
When the day comes to an end, he invites you to attend Evening Under Lamplight. It's Cambridge 105 Radio.
Thank you, Neil Henry. Now, here's another kind of game, something we don't usually think of as a game, but why not? It fits our category. I'm talking about jokes. Joke as a kind of game. It's certainly a sport, a diversion from ordinary life, and it's told for its own sake, unless, of course, you've gone professional and you do it for money. And there are rules that create their own alternative world. When someone starts telling a joke, we relax a little, knowing that we're entering for a moment this other world, a world that will, we hope, make us laugh. It will disport us. What are the rules of a joke? I suppose the basic rule is that a joke must somehow tease us. It has to set up certain expectations that we hold on to, and then it upsets these expectations, leading to an unexpected place. Here are a few short jokes based around the character Nasruddin, a legendary Sufi wise man, or sometimes a fool. The two often can be interchangeable after all. Many of the stories featuring Nasruddin as the central character can also be found as Yiddish jokes. I've never found an explanation of how the same stories appear in the two different cultures, but why should we be surprised at this kind of overlapping? Nasruddin lived in a region of Persia in the 13th century, that is, roughly in the same place and time as the poet Rumi. Here is Coleman Barks, starting off with Rumi and then giving us his modern adaptations of a few Nasruddin jokes.
Rumi loved laughter, and his community was noticed that there are many ways that human consciousness changes, especially like when you're about to hear a joke. Nasruddin takes a tuna fish sandwich to work every day, and at lunch he takes one bite out of it and throws it away. His co-worker says, "Nasruddin, you ought to have your wife fix some other kind of sandwich." And he says, "Ah, my friend, it is not so simple as that. I am not married. I fix these for myself." Nasruddin is in the sanctuary. He has his feet up on the altar. They come and say, "Nasruddin, put your feet down. This is a holy place." He says, "Where will I put them?" Nasruddin knows the value of exercise. He says, "My mother has begun, and when she was 60 years old, walking 5 miles a day. And now she's 90, and we have no idea where she is." Nasruddin is walking into a town, and he sees a wall full of bullseyes. And a perfect shot in every one. A young man with a rifle is standing nearby. Nasruddin says, "How did you get to be such a perfect marksman?" He says, "No problem. First I shoot the wall, and then I draw circles around where it lands. That way I get a bullseye every time." Nasruddin reflects that there is some deception in the young man's life, but that his knowledge has practical application. He has solved the problem we all have of being off center. Nasruddin, it's 4 a.m. He's leaving the tavern. He's drunk. And he begins walking aimlessly around town. The police stop him and say, "Nasruddin, why are you wandering with no purpose around town?" And Nasruddin says, "Sir, if I knew the answer to that question, I would have been home hours ago."
Yes, there are some lessons to be learned from these little jokes, but we don't go to these stories for the lessons. We go for the sake of the story, the joke, the sport of it. The lessons just add another dimension to the joke. As Coleman Barks says, Rumi's community knew that the human consciousness changes when we're about to hear a joke. We shift into this other world, expecting the unexpected twist. And the rules? Well, I suppose the main rule of a Nasruddin story can be seen in the pattern that most of the stories take. Nasruddin is doing something puzzling. Someone asks him what he's doing, and he replies with an apparently nonsensical answer, but one that after a second or two reveals a deeper meaning than the questioner and us, the listeners, had ever expected. In some stories, though, like the one with the marksman drawing a circle around the bullet hole, it is Nasruddin who asks the questions, and then when he gets the answer, he applies it in an original way. The man who drew bull's eyes around the bullet holes has, Nasruddin concludes, solved the problem we all have of being off-center. Ponder that for a while. Here's another joke. It involves a Jewish joke, but this is not the main point, only the occasion of the main joke. We'll hear from Lenny Bruce about his experience in the late 50s or early 60s with an appearance on the popular television show, The Steve Allen Show. It illustrates, among other things, the difference between those for whom telling a joke is a game and those for whom it's all about money. Have you ever heard Lenny Bruce before? He speaks with the laid-back drawl of a hipster, combining beatnik slang with a sprinkling of Yiddish, and with a New York accent overall. And he's a real mensch.
Oh, let me tell you about the Steve Allen Show. First Steve Allen, I want to tell you about him. Of all the comedians that I've ever met, he is the most literate. Second, he's the most moral comic I ever met. Guy is very conscious of societal problems and interested in them. Not only talks about it, but does things about it. So he's a good man, a good person. Without being saccharine and old showbiz. I really dig him for that. I did the show twice. I was a little bugged with the show because of continuity. Censors. If I do a show, if I work for an hour here, out of the hour I'll do maybe, although I create everything myself and everything I tell you and make you laugh that I've created on the stage, of the hour I will ad-lib 4 minutes tops. Sometimes very fertile, about 10 minutes, but that's a good night. Usually about 4 minutes, top, free form. But for me ever to have to come out and open with the same word every night and finish with the same word and do the same bits in each show in order, then I don't feel like a comic at all. And you got to do this on television, and it's a bug for me. They sat me down there, and they all sat there, 15 guys, and I'm doing the bits. Steve Allen's got a very hip sense of humor, and he cracks up at everything I'm doing. Producer Bill Harbeck is hip, but he's got a little more to lose. So he gives these kind of laughs like, ha, ha, gee, yeah. Now I went into a bit they didn't let me do on the Allen Show. I have a tattoo. It's not a cockamamie or anything. It doesn't rub off. Because of this tattoo, I never can be buried in a Jewish cemetery. That's the Orthodox scene. You have to go out of the world the way you came in. No marks, no changes. Which certainly disobeys the rabbi philosophy. I don't know where that swings. I got back from Malta, so I'm over at my aunt's house in Jamaica, Long Island. I'm in the kitchen, I'm washing with a Roki soap. She pins the tattoo. So she looks and she flips. She went, ah! It's a real Jewish seagull, you know. Look at you then. You ruin your arm. You can't be buried in a Jewish cemetery. I said, Mima, what are you nudging me? They'll cut this off. They'll bury this in a Gentile cemetery. Like, all right? Okay. Now, the guy says to me, You can't do that joke. Why not? He says, well, it's definitely offensive to the Jewish people. I says, and you're out of your nut, man. He says, no, that's it. And son, any time we get any satires, any ethnic groups, there's a lot of mail and you can't do the joke. I said, well, screw it. I'm not going to do the show, man. That's it. So there he goes, ha, 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 ha. That's the first defense with me all the time, Mike. Ha, ha, ha. He's a nut, right? Oh, no, don't be a baby. Be a man. Sell out. I don't make any bones about the fact that sometimes I'm irreverent and sometimes I allow myself, this is a rationalization, the same poetic license as Tennessee Williams or Shakespeare. If I want to, in other words, I'll never use four-letter words for shock value, for laugh, but if it fits the character, then I want to swing with it and say it. Naturally, I know I can't do this on television, but here I'm not making any scatological references. I'm just doing a true kind of bit. So now, I'm really getting hot with a guy. You're not going to do the joke, and yes, and don't tell us, and blah, blah. Well, listen, we'll talk. We'll have a meeting. He says, you can't, don't know meeting. This guy really putting zingers in. There's one guy, I really hate him. He's got a Bank of America collar there, you know. And he said, he can't, it's offensive to the Jewish people. Now they argue for about an hour. They keep me in the corner. I'm like the leper with a bell on my neck waiting. The guy goes back, he says, we talked it all over, Lenny. You know, it's definitely offensive to the Gentile people, too. Oh, yeah? How do you figure that? He says, well, what you're saying in essence is that the Gentiles don't care what they bury.
My favorite line from this clip is, don't be a baby, be a man, sell out. That's wonderful. Real men sell out and go for the money. Maybe that's why they get their first heart attack in their early 50s. There's an interesting historical perspective to games, which we might say reached their most prestigious social position in the later Middle Ages with the cult of chivalry. Chivalry defined life by a careful set of courtly rules. The poets often debated the finer points of these rules, deciding who was truly chivalrous and who wasn't. There was one story, for instance, I think by Marie de France, that tells how Guinevere was abducted by an evil knight. Here comes a little story. She was abducted by an evil knight, and Lancelot set out to rescue her. He rode for days on end, but finally his horse died, so he walked on for many days, in full armor, of course. He was progressing very slowly, and along came a peasant in a horse-drawn cart full of straw. Lancelot saw his chance and asked, or demanded, that seems more likely, to have a ride in the back of the cart, which was traveling faster than he could walk, and anyway, if he rested a bit, he could regain his strength. So after another day's journey, he finally reached the evil knight's castle, where Guinevere was being kept prisoner. He broke down the gates, killed the evil knight and all his followers, and rescued the queen. "Now I can take you safely back to Camelot," said Lancelot. "Oh, no, you're not. I'm not going anywhere with you. You defiled yourself," Guinevere said, "by getting into that cart and traveling like a peasant. Have you no respect for me that you had to lower yourself to such an extent?" Don't ask me what happened next. I don't remember. But you see the point. Lancelot broke the rules, at least as Guinevere saw them. This was a foul, a bad foul. He was out of the game. It can all seem very silly, especially in the writings of Marie de France and others who were mocking the rules, but behind it was something very significant. If their Christian faith said that service to others was the highest calling, that this life was not real but only a rehearsal for the next life, and that the ends do not justify the means, but every action in their life was judged for its own moral quality, then it made sense to see this life as a game, which had to be played by strict rules. What mattered was how you played the game, and then if you did right, you would, incidentally, win. Right makes might. I'm oversimplifying, of course. So the code of chivalry says that the knight defers to the lady, he serves the lady, his wishes do not count, and the lady is just some ideal image up on a pedestal. You don't fight to win, but to do right. And then, if you're right, you will win. It's God as the umpire above all, as in the Kinks song. And the motto is right makes might. There's a flaw in this, of course. Doing the right thing does not automatically ensure that you will succeed. And if it did, then you wouldn't be doing right for its own sake, but only as a kind of insurance policy against anything going wrong for you. You go rescue Guinevere not because it's the right thing to do, but because you will get some benefit from it afterwards, either a kind glance from her or a kiss, or, on a higher scale, a place in heaven. As we've seen, doing it for gain is not in the spirit of games, nor is it the spirit of true chivalry. And the idea of right makes might has become a convenient way to justify oppressing poor people. They have no might down there at the bottom of society. Therefore, they cannot have acted right. They deserve every hardship they have, and we, on top, don't have to feel obliged to help them in any way. You know the way those rich, powerful people talk. That takes us to another major flaw of chivalry. The knight is sworn to serve people in distress, but in fact, this applies only to people of his own upper class. Everyone else can be trampled upon, sometimes literally. And an upper-class woman is not human, but more like an angel, a delicate creature, unable to fend for herself. And when people clung to the game beyond its time, the game got pretty rotten. Jonathan Swift wrote a few poems about a naive... Here's another story. About a naive young man, Strephon, who has bought into this chivalry game and thinks ladies are divine. On the day he is about to marry heavenly Chloe, he shaves 3 times so his whiskers do not injure her cheek, so delicate is she. They get married and go to bed at the end of the day. Warning, this story is about to become a little offensive. Maybe not in the way you think. Strephon turns around in the marriage bed, turns around to embrace Chloe, but she fends him off. Okay, he figures, she's so high-minded that she's not ready for this sort of earthy thing. A little later, he tries again and again, she puts him off. And he tries the 3rd time, and now she not only turns away from him, but she reaches out to the bedpan on the floor by the bed and squats over it and relieves herself. See, it turns out she had drunk too much tea at the wedding party. Well, Strephon is horror-struck. He cries out, "Gracious heavens, what is this? Can Chloe, heavenly Chloe, piss? Bodily functions are not part of the rules of the chivalry game. But when you have to piss, you have to call time out from the game, right?" Strephon's mind just can't take this in.
What's the ugliest part of your body? What's the ugliest part of your body? Some say your nose. Some say your toes. I think it's your mind.
Your mind.
I think it's your mind.
That was a bit from the Mothers of Inventions album. We're only in it for the money. As usual, being both honest and mocking. Back to chivalry for a few more minutes. When I used to teach a course in the myth of chivalry, we'd always end with William Faulkner's story, A Rose for Emily, which deals with the way the upper-class culture in the American South was rotting by the end of the 19th century, partly because of its adherence to those worn-out chivalrous codes. In this story, Emily is a lady from an aristocratic family whose father has sent off every suitor because no one was good enough for his daughter. Eventually, the father dies, and Emily takes up with some outsider from the north. Everyone thinks they'll get married, but one day the man disappears and is never seen again. And soon there's an awful stench coming from Emily's decaying mansion. Someone suggests they must tell Emily that she has to clear up whatever is making that stink. But Judge Stevens, a chivalrous gentleman of the old school, cries out, "Damn it, sir! Will you accuse a lady to her face of smelling bad?" You see, it's not chivalrous to imply anything bad about a lady, least of all about a stink. You'd rather live with the stink. And eventually, after Emily's death, the town discovers that the stink had come from the corpse of her fiancé, whom she had killed, and next to whose decaying body she had been sleeping every night for many years. His decaying body, of course, points to the decaying game of chivalry. You can play a game only so far, folks.
Lay, lady, lay, lay across my big brass bed. Lay, lady, lay, lay across my big brass bed. Whatever colors you have in your mind, I show them to you, and you see them shine. Lay, lady, lay, lay across my big brass bed. Stay, lady, stay, stay with your man a while. Until the break of day, let me see you make 'em smile.
All right, no comment about playing Dylan's Lay, Lady, Lay to compliment Faulkner's Rose for Emily. We're almost at the end of the show, but there's one more twist to the theme of games that we must attend to, another corruption of the practice. I'm thinking of the way people use the word game to mean simply doing anything you can in order to win. The exact opposite of what I hope we've been discussing as a truer sense of the word. Don't play your games with me, we might say, and we mean something like, be honest, don't deceive me with your attempts to get the better of me. Or it can be put the other way. I'm not playing any games here. Yes, I'm being straight with you. This is real life, you and me, honest together. Or in another usage, Joe Tech's threat, I'll teach you to play with my affection. I've been hearing the word used also as a verb, as in, one of the first things he did to game the election was to appoint his own people as poll workers on election day. The Oxford English Dictionary tells us that this usage is originally American, of course, and cites its first occurrence in writing as 1967. It defines the verb as to manipulate. In other words, to game is to manipulate a situation to one's own advantage, especially in a way that is fraudulent or underhand, to rig, to fix, frequently in the expression to game the system. And here's The Guardian from 2012. Any system can be gamed if someone knows the right tricks to play. But we know better, you and I, don't we? We know that the only way to experience the delight of playing a game is to enter into it for its own sake. and to stretch the rules but not break them. Well, there's a lot more we could have said on this topic. The game of love, for instance, or that whole activity of war games. But I'll leave that for you to play with. But here's one final thought I want to squeeze in here. The Kinks began their song saying, "Some people think that life's a game. Well, if this is so, I'd like to know the rules on which the game of life is played." Yes, let's entertain the idea that life is a game, but not with the kind of oppressive, self-righteous, spirit-killing rules the cricket master imposes, and not with the worn-out social values of chivalry. I think the best thing about seeing life as a game is, at least in the terms we've been using here, is that we can then focus on our actions at the moment. We're not out to win in life. We're not gaming our life, but playing our life as a game, or even as a drama in which we have been cast in the character we find ourselves encased in. Our motto in this game might be the lines from Walt Whitman's Song of Myself that I referred to a short while ago. "The world," Whitman says, "is full of pulling and hauling, everyone struggling to play their part in the game as best they can, or struggling to beat everyone else and win the goods at the end. But I," Whitman says, "I stand apart from this. That is, my essential self, deeper than the ego. What I am," as he puts it. "What I am stands there as a spectator of the way others are playing the game, and the way I too am playing it. I'm standing there, amused by it all, and pleased at the way it's working out, and compassionate towards all the unavoidable misfortunes and pain. And idle, not pulling and hauling, and finally I'm united, not in conflict within myself. And I'm standing there in a classic pose of the philosophical onlooker, lounging, eyes down, standing erect, my arm bent on some resting place, giving sideways looks, waiting to see what's coming next in this game that I am both a part of and not a part of, but fully enjoying." Or in Whitman's own words, "Apart from the pulling and hauling stands what I am. Stands amused, complacent, compassionating, idle, unitary. Looks down, is erect, or bends an arm on an impalpable certain rest, looking with wide side-curved head, curious what will come next, both in and out of the game, and watching and wondering at it." And if we play this game of life like this, we may win or we may not, but we won't care. We'll be attentive to something else. And instead of stressing out and rushing in anxiety, perhaps we'll enjoy taking our time and going slow, like Leonard Cohen, who will close out the show this evening. But before we go, let me obey the rules once more and remind you that you've been listening to Evening Under Lamplight on Cambridge 105 Radio with me, Robert Louis Abrahamson. Get back to me at lamplight@cambridge105.co.uk. And hear the archives at momentsunderlamplight.co.uk. And here's Leonard Cohen, "Slow," from the 2014 album Popular Problems.
I'm slowing down the tune. I never liked it fast. You want to get there soon, I want to get there last. It's not because I'm old, it's not the life I led. I always liked it slow, that's what my mama said. I'm lacing up my shoe, but I don't want to run. I'll get there when I do. Starting gun. It's not because I'm old, and it's not what dying does. I always liked it slow. slow. I never liked it fast. With you, it's got to go. With me, it's got to last. It's not because I'm old. It's not because I'm dead. I always liked it slow. That's what my mama said. Your moves are swift, all your turns are tight. Let me catch my breath, I thought we had all night. I like to take my time, I like to linger as it flies. A weekend on your lips, a lifetime in your eyes. It's not because I'm old. It's not the life I led. I always liked it slow. That's what my mama said. I'm slowing down the